Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. My name is Dave Marshall and you're listening to episode 156 on bird necks with Dr. Ryan Marek of University College London. Now, as you know, whenever the show goes missing for a bit, we have to go through my usual list of apologies and excuses. And for the last couple of months, I've gone from having COVID to working offshore and generally just having everything that life could throw at me all happening all at once. It really drives home that I can't do everything I want without loads of help. And so for that reason, I've put out an ad for new PaleoCast team members. So, if you have a postgraduate degree in paleontology or any closely related field, and are interested in co-hosting the show, appearing on video, recording gameplay, or simply writing blog posts, then I'd love to hear from you. Application details are already available on our website, and I'll be making some appointments very soon. That said, I'm going to leave the applications open, so please feel free to drop me an email at any time. As for this episode on bird necks, I'm speaking to Dr. Ryan Marek, who is quite the neckspert. He describes how, having invested all of the functionality of their forelimbs into flying, birds have found their beaks to be particularly handy, especially when armed with a flexible neck. Bird necks serve a variety of functions, and they've played an enormous, yet poorly recognised role in driving the evolutionary success of this hugely diverse group. Remember that as we talk about all these different birds, pictures will be available on our website, and there you'll also be able to find our archive of past shows, all sorted by geological period for your browsing pleasure. You can also find us on social media and subscribe to us wherever you find your podcasts. I hope you enjoy this episode. Hi, Ryan. Thank you so much for coming onto the show today.
Hi, no, thanks very much for having me.
Right, this interview has been a long time coming. We should have had you on a lot longer ago, I feel. But anyway, we need to introduce you to our audience. So could you tell us a bit about your background? How did you first become involved in the field of paleontology?
So I think, like a lot of elder millennial paleontologists, it was a healthy dose of Jurassic Park and David Attenborough documentaries that like initially got my interest in paleontology, the natural world. And then through that, I found out about paleontology as like a job you could do. And then I've just really ran with that for the last 15 years, I guess now, almost 15 years, yeah, since I first started my undergrad. So yeah, it's been
and then MSc, PhD?
Yeah, I did the undergraduate master's course at Bristol, did my PhD at Liverpool, and then now I'm doing a postdoc at UCL on kind of adjacent to paleontology, but still kind of evolutionary studies, occasionally looking at fossils, but yeah, always keeping my eye onto the fossil record as much as I can.
And do you have any idea what you'd be doing if you hadn't have taken this path?
Definitely would be kind of around the sector. I've done a lot of outreach before, so and I enjoyed that. So kind of like science communication for sure. That would definitely be kind of the area I would be if I wasn't like hardcore science paleontology.
Still kind of in the same ballpark though,
yeah,
but
yeah.
Come on, out of left field though.
Left field. I've always thought I could be a writer, but I don't think that's true, but we never know. We'll see.
Well, you've authored plenty of papers, so.
Yeah, we'll see. Not right. Exactly the same, but yeah.
Why did you end up studying birds? Is this something that you wanted to get into? I mean, birds, dinosaurs,
I mean, if you told 5-year-old me that I'd be studying birds, not dinosaurs, he'd probably be absolutely mortified. But, it was kind of the scenario when I started my PhD. I was like, look, I want to study neck evolution in dinosaurs. And then my supervisor was like, you need to sort this problem out in birds because we don't know anything about birds. Because realistically, I think, you know, we might get onto this at some point in the interview that to look back into the fossil record, you need to understand whatever you're studying in extant animals, if possible. We just didn't really know anything about bird necks up until 10, 15 years ago, realistically. So I was like, well, I've got to sort this out before I can get back in the fossil record, and I'm still sorting it out, I guess. So, yeah.
And, you know, like, what makes birds a good group to study in general?
Well, I've since seen the light. They're amazing. They're everywhere. They're successful. They've got a lot of variation. And, yeah, everywhere you go, you'll see a bird. You'll see a different bird. Like, we went to Australia for a conference a few weeks ago, and it was just amazing to see and hear a completely different set of birds compared to the UK. It was, yeah. And you'll get that in most continents you visit. It's just, they're everywhere and they're just really cool. Yeah.
Right. So you, as you said, you've been looking at their necks. Before we go into details of bird necks, can you first explain to us what necks are in general? I know that's a bit of a weird question. It sounds kind of simplistic, like a neck is a neck. It joins your head to your body. Yeah. What is it that they do other than that?
I mean, you've said it right there. It is a separation from your kind of shoulder girdle and the rest of your body to your head. And you might think, well, how's that important? But, you know, if you want a kind of an exercise you can do at home, kind of put your head between your shoulders and try and look around the room without using your neck. It's incredibly difficult. So you're making just the act of looking around, observing your surroundings, incredibly hard to do. So with that degree of movement between your head and the rest of your body, it opens up a wide array of behaviors, of observance. Just the ability to freely look around whilst you're walking, for example, is an enormous advantage to basically every vertebrate on Earth.
Right, okay. Do we know where they came from?
So we can kind of see muscle precursors to kind of current neck muscles in some fishes. The kind of structural bare bones are kind of in certain fishes, but they definitely kind of first arose in when we first came out of land, first came out of water. Like Tiktaalik, we start to see like the very first emergences of the separation of the head and the shoulder girdle with the neck. So it's really associated with coming onto land, where, you know, you need to look up, down, left, right, rather than just shifting your entire body like a lot of fish do.
Yeah, so fish don't have necks.
Fish, now that is actually a area of current debate. I think I've got some colleagues in the University of Liverpool that are trying to answer this exact question, because people think fish vertebrae are essentially the entire vertebral column is very similar to each other. You don't get much regionalization. But in fact, you kind of do get a really short neck in some fish. And yeah, it's an area of active debate. So watch this space about fish necks, I guess.
Wow, I'm just like going through all the fishes in my head. Like the only one that I could think of is maybe a seahorse or something. But is that just like a bent body?
Yeah, it kind of is. And when I talk about fish necks, I'm not talking about them like having a kind of a visually recognizable neck like we have. We're talking purely about vertebral shape, and if that allows some more degree of movement between the so-called head and the so-called body.
Yeah, okay. And so then I'm thinking of like what it's like to not have a neck, like fish potentially. So you can't really separate your head from your body. You can't look around. But then, you know, like most animals in the world, so like invertebrates, like insects and whatnot, they don't have necks.
True, but also not true. Some snake flies and some giraffe weevils have kind of this integument between their head and kind of their thorax, which is called the cervix. And it's kind of this integumentary structure which acts as kind of a simplified neck with like one or two joints. You're right. A lot of insects don't have kind of a neck that we would associate with vertebrates, but they've also got enormous eyes which can receive light and view the world from a lot more different angles than we can. You know, we as humans have got kind of forward-facing eyes, but insects can have a huge range of vision compared to us. So, and they can flit about here, there, and everywhere within the blink of an eye because they've got such, you know, rapid flight mechanics as well.
Right. So, looking at the vertebrates then, how much variation is there within necks kind of generally?
Generally, there's an enormous amount of variation, especially if we include the fossil record. I mean, the fossil record is where we get absolutely amazing examples of neck evolution. We think about the plesiosaurs, we think about Tanystropheus, we think about even as dark as pterosaurs. Their necks are absolutely enormous. But even in modern vertebrates, we can see, for example, whales. They have 7 cervical vertebrae like all mammals do, but it's a very short and restricted cervical vertebra. But then we contrast that with a giraffe. They still have 7 cervical vertebrae, but their necks are enormous. And then outside of mammals, we've got birds, we've got reptiles, all with an enormous amount of variation in their cervical vertebrae and the neck morphology. So yeah, when you combine the extinct and the extant organisms, you get an enormous amount of variation in neck morphology down to a kind of a granular detail as well.
Okay, and is there anything that's constraining, that's preventing the evolution of some really wild and wacky necks? Why is it that we don't have kind of, you know, like necks that are acting like a slinky spring or something like that?
I think primarily it's what the neck is generally there to do all the time, and that is support the weight of the head. Because if you can't support your head, then, you know, you don't deserve a neck, really, because that's the whole point. That's the whole point of a neck. You need to hold up your head at all times, unless you're in the water, and that's kind of different because you've got kind of the density of water holding your head kind of for you in that regard. But if you're a terrestrial vertebrate, you know, the weight of your head is the main constraining force of your neck. So that's why we don't get wacky morphologies, because even if the neck can do a lot of interesting functions, like we see in birds, it still needs to constantly support the head so we can correctly view the world around us at all times.
So does that link the mass of the head to the morphology, the shape of the neck? So you can't really have a really thin and slender neck if you've got a massive, big, heavy head?
Not necessarily, unless somehow you're living in like zero gravity or you're living in the water. But even then, we see, for example, like plesiosaurs, they have really long necks, but they've still got really small heads. So in that case, they're not supporting the weight of the head, but they still need to move around the weight of the head when they're feeding, for example. So if you've got a really long neck, but you want to move a really heavy head around, it's going to be really hard for you to do, even in water, if you've got a massive head. So you kind of need to balance not only supporting your head, but also the energy it would take for the neck to move around a big head wherever it needs to go as well.
Yeah. All right. So you've said about, and I know that this is something that gets pointed out, like whales have 7 cervical vertebrae, the neck vertebrae. Giraffes also have 7, but the completely different shape. Do we always have 7?
Mammals do. It's very restricted in mammals. Only kind of slower moving mammals like sloths, manatees, have more or less cervical vertebrae, but even then, you know, they're restricted to 8 or 9 tops, or maybe 6. They don't go to the plesiosaur kind of shadow realm of like 70 cervical vertebrae or something insane like that. And that's a lot of developmental factors that are at play there to do with kind of fallen musculature development and how that interacts with neck development during the embryonic stages. And as well, it's kind of a lot of pleiotropic effects of certain genes. Unfortunately, a lot of cervical cancers and child cancers are kind of weirdly associated with any change in the neck formula in humans.
Wow.
It's kind of got a whole medical aspect as well to it, which has obviously been very well studied because it's really important to like pediatrics, for example. But there definitely is a deep underlying developmental side to the restriction of mammalian cervical vertebra.
Yeah, and it does seem like there's a lot of work that, as you said, a lot of work that's gone into that. When I was reading your review paper, which everyone should do, it's a great paper,
thank you.
Going through the genetics bit, I was like, okay, I'm just going to flip the page over and get back into the evolution, please. So, yeah, we've got mammals that all have the same number, but then outside of that, we could have a bit of a difference. But is there also a difference between the cervical vertebrae themselves? So, like, your first one is this shape and size. The last one is completely different.
Yeah, so there is, across a lot of different vertebrae, there is kind of a gradational pattern of neck morphology from one vertebra to the next, all the way down through to the last cervical vertebra. And this is, you know, slight tangent, but, you know, when you see those, it's coming up to that time of year now, it's September, where we see all the spooky skeletons that you can put around your house as part of Halloween decorations. All the vertebrae will be exactly the same shape across all of those kind of ornaments. And every year it's like, well, this is clearly wrong. But that seemingly that a lot of the public seems to think that that's how vertebral morphology exists. Like all the vertebrae are the same, but that's just, it's just not true. We across different regions of vertebral morphology, from cervical to thoracic to lumbar and sacral, we kind of have this gradational pattern of vertebral morphology.
All right. I want the audience to send in their pictures of the worst Halloween decorations they see. I've got a Halloween spider skeleton.
Oh, I knew and that it's just was like, coming. Oh, it annoys me every year.
But there's worse. I'm sure I've seen something like a snail skeleton or something daft.
It's when they give bird skeletons like hands, a little bit like pterosaurs, but it's mad. It's absolutely mad. But anyway,
yeah, we'll get angry about those together. So all of those skeletons are missing one thing, and that is soft tissues.
Yep.
So we've not really talked too much about the soft tissues of the neck. Does that vary? What kinds of things actually go through the neck? How complicated is it?
The neck is very complicated musculoskeletal system that can change. The soft tissues can change between a lot of different groups. So between birds and mammals, for example, mammals have a lot of enormous tendons on the dorsal surface, on the top surface of their necks, for example, like the nuchal ligament, and that's really there to support the big heavy heads of a lot of mammals. But even between species of birds, it can change massively. Like, we got some examples of bird cervical morphology of their muscles. Well, I did a lot of that work during my PhD, and we were discovering new things in 2015 that have never been seen in science before, just because it's a really complicated musculoskeletal system, so no one's really gone in there. It's kind of hard to get specimens of like penguins and sariemas and stuff like that, which we managed to get our hands on. So yeah, it's a it's a field that is just ripe for a lot of questions to be answered about musculoskeletal variation in not just bird necks, but vertebrate necks more generally.
I am getting the impression that you've done a lot of dissection.
Yep.
What's the weirdest bird that you've... or the rarest, or... Serema's a pretty...
Yeah, that was pretty cool. I guess a penguin neck was pretty cool. It was just cool to see the whole kind of step dissection where you're getting first-hand of experience what, like, feathers on a penguin's are actually like. It's kind of weird. But their neck was entirely different than what we'd ever seen before. Some of the muscles were just enormous where they should be absolutely tiny. But that's all to do with, you know, adaptations to the aquatic realm and other things like that. We dissected a full ostrich. That was fun and very smelly.
Because they'd all come in like formaldehyde or something, wouldn't they?
Well, the ostrich came from a farm just outside of Liverpool, which we had to go and collect in one of our colleagues' small car, which is a story maybe for another time.
For right now, did you get pulled over by the police or anything?
No, we didn't, but the rigor mortis started to set in, so it's very very difficult to get out of the car at the other end.
Just open the sunroof and there's net.
Yeah, it wasn't far off that, to be fair.
Right. Okay. Yeah, so... what are the craziest necks in the animal kingdom?
I'm very obviously focused on birds, yeah. So I'm going to try and not discuss birds forevermore. I think the neck of giraffes is cool because the last cervical vertebra going on to the first thoracic vertebra, the first thoracic vertebra has been kind of in like quotation marks, like cervicalized. So their first thoracic vertebra looks very much like a cervical vertebra. So it looks very much like a neck vertebra. And that's really interesting because that allows even more elongation of the neck. Mm. So more of their vertebral column is essentially acting as a neck than most mammals. That's why the giraffe neck's pretty cool. You get birds called anhingers or darter birds, or they're also called snake birds as well. They've kind of got this hinge joint halfway through their neck, which allows them to make really rapid strikes. They literally spear fish in the rivers that they occupy. So they make really rapid strikes and put their whole beak through fish, you know, much like we do when we, you know, would go spear fishing thousands of years ago or now, if, you know, that's your hobby. But, you know, that's a specialized hinge joint which allows the head and neck to move insanely fast. The neck of woodpeckers, obviously, is, you know, designed pretty much like a jackhammer, allowing the head to generate a lot of force so they can pierce bark, for example. I could talk for days, obviously. Just a few highlights, I guess.
Right. So moving on to birds then. Why are necks so important to birds? And is there a distinction between, you know, the necks of birds and the necks of every other vertebrate?
I think there is. We see, especially in modern vertebrates, if we restrict it to that, birds have a lot of variation. On a lot of different scales of morphology. So we go from the level of total neck morphology. So what does a neck look like when you're looking at the whole animal? That can be very different. So for example, neck length could be very different across different birds. And then this can change all the way down to the level of individual vertebral morphology. So say we compare the middle vertebrae across a few species of birds, they're all going to be different. They're going to display a lot of differences in length, width, height, many different aspects of vertebral anatomy. So they can, there's so much variation in the neck morphology of birds on a huge amount of scales.
So there's a lot of variation in how they look and I guess how they function, but what uses do they have for them? What kinds of roles have birds employed their necks for?
Kind of on a spectrum of a generalist behavior, the neck has often been thought of like classically as a functional unit which has kind of a generalist function. So you think about what you use your neck for, it's for observance, it's for vigilance, it's for eating, it's for drinking. In the, you know, in birds, it's for anything they need to manipulate their environment with, they need to do it with their beak. So they need to be able to move their head around in any which way to do a multitude of tasks across any given day. So like I said, that's a lot of different behaviors, from stuff they do every day, from drinking and eating, all the way to specialized functions. So as you know, I talked about the darter, if it needs to do some spearfishing, then that's a more specialized function that it might do. And then if we look at kind of carnivorous birds, falcons, eagles, owls, they also have more specialized functions in terms of owls with their neck rotation, or with more carnivorous birds, they need to generate a lot of force to rip flesh from prey as well. So yeah, they've kind of got that dichotomy of they need to A, support their head, B, do all the daily activities which all birds need to do, eating, drinking, observance, for example, but they also need to do a lot of specialized activities which, you know, vary between different groups of birds.
Yeah, one of the things that I read that I overlooked a lot was the stabilization. But then I was thinking, you know, we've all seen the videos on social media of someone moving a chicken around or a bird of prey or something, and the head stays absolutely stationary regardless of whatever the body's been moved to do. Yeah, so how important is that stabilization? Is that something that all birds could do? Ish? Maybe not a penguin.
To a degree, I'm not sure about that reflexes in every bird. I know it is great social media fodder because someone's decided to, I think, as a little aside, someone decided that they couldn't afford like a Steadicam, so they used a chicken. They put a little camera on top of the chicken's head and used that as kind of a Steadicam. It's all kind of little things that you put in your conference talks to make it a little bit more bearable for your audience. But yeah, that reflex is in a lot of birds. I'm not sure it's in all. But when I talk about neck stabilization, it's primarily during flight. Because if you're a bird, if you're flying and you're flapping your wings, and if you can't really manipulate your neck to account for that, you're going to get a lot of distortion in your field of vision because your arms are flapping like mad, and then that's going to mean your head's going to be bobbing up and down constantly. You're going to get travel sick after a while, really, as a bird. But what the neck allows birds to do is to counteract that movement, that up and down flapping movement. So there's, like we've seen on all those social media clips, during flight, they can keep their heads stable. So that means their vision is stable. So that means they can clearly see where they need to go. They need to clearly be able to see any predators or prey. So when we talk about stabilization, I think that's the primary driver of certain aspects of neck morphology, because they need to stabilize their vision during flight.
One of the things that you talk about is the notion that a bird's neck is used as a surrogate arm. Can you explain what that means?
Yeah, so this is kind of an idea which I had about 2 years into my PhD, and it's one of those eureka moments that when you think about something that you've been studying for years and years and years, and then you just view it in a completely different light. It happened, I was speaking to someone at a conference, and they mentioned that, oh, you know, the head of birds is used like a surrogate hand, because bird wings, they're adapted for flight. That's basically all they can do. And that's kind of reductionist, and bird wings are amazing. Bird forms are amazing. They can do a lot of really cool things. Flight is an incredible achievement for birds. But it has made the forelimbs of birds useless in basically every other regard apart from locomotion. So birds still need to interact with their environment on a day-to-day basis. They need to build nests. They need to preen their feathers. That's a really important aspect of bird behavior. How do they do this? Well, they use their hand. They use their beaks as a surrogate hand. So if we extend that analogy, then the neck is acting like a surrogate arm. So it's moving the beak, the surrogate hand, where it needs to go, just like our arms move our hands to where they need to go to interact with our environment. Birds are doing exactly the same, but with their neck and their heads as well.
So if I'm thinking about a very necky bird, say like a swan, are there any constraints on how that neck is able to move? I mean, it just looks like a beautiful white body, then a giant white noodle, and then a head at the end. Are they constrained in how they move? Are there any movements that they can't do or anything like that?
So I think, to start off the question in a kind of a morbid context, during the dissections, I found that a lot of bird necks, you can basically tie them in knots. Their restrictions are kind of split into two. On a base level, it's really all about the connections of the bones themselves. So birds have kind of like a saddle, a shaped joint, which is the primary attachment or primary site of connection between two adjacent vertebrae. And that restricts movements on kind of a dorsiventral, so up and down, and then lateral movements. It does restrict that to a degree. Also, birds have other bony processes called zygapophyses, which further restrict kind of torsional or rotation in a kind of more lateral context. They restrict that rotation. So on one level, we have hard constraints by the bone morphology, and then another constraint is that yes, they have a huge amount of range of motion which we can manipulate when they're dead or when we're dissecting them, but in reality we have a spinal cord that runs throughout all of our vertebrae, and that carries really important nerve bundles. So if that gets bent at a really horrific angle, then, you know, that's game over. That bird is unfortunately dead. So that's another hard anatomical limit. You cannot bend your neck or your vertebral column at any one point past a certain angle. Otherwise, your spinal cord will just break. And that's bad news. You don't want, as a vertebrate, you don't want that to happen, right? but realistically, when a bird is alive, what is important in terms of limiting the range of motion, it is all about the active involvement of the muscles working in tandem with the hard constraints of bone morphology. And as well, as you layer up bone, muscle, tendons, and skin, you actually do start to restrict that range of motion quite heavily. I say restrict quite heavily, you know, birds' necks can display a huge amount of range of motion. But those are the two kind of main areas of why you can't just tie the necks of birds in knots, for example.
Right. So I want to link together the use of the neck, behaviors, ecology, to the shape of the neck, morphology. So if we took into account certain behaviors, pecking, what else do birds do?
So I think two of the general, well, three of the general activities that Birdnecks kind of utilized in pecking, drinking, and preening. So a kind of a downwards motion when they're pecking and drinking, and then moving their neck all the way around back to their own bodies to preen their feathers. Those are kind of three big movements that basically all birds were involved in, have evolved to utilize their neck as a part of. So, as I said before, the neck of birds needs to be adapted. Their morphology needs to allow for those three activities to take place basically at all times in all birds. So most birds, their cervical morphology is generally adapted to do that. And that almost kind of acts as a constraint, what we found in some of our research in the last few years. So only when a bird needs to do a really specialized task with its neck. So, for example, we think about a falcon or an eagle. That bird needs to use its neck for a very specialized task in terms of ripping flesh from whatever prey item it's eating. And that's a specialized function because it needs to put a lot of power through the neck to allow the head and the beak to tear chunks of flesh from the prey. So in that instance, that specialized function needs to have the morphological adaptations that underlie it. So in that case, it will kind of break that generalized constraint. So not only will it be able to do all the eating, drinking, and then preening activities, but now it also needs a specialized function. So in specialized cases, bird neck morphology will become specialized. And it's the same for aquatic birds. That is such a specialized niche with its own set of specialized challenges that birds need to come over with their necks and the rest of their body, that neck morphology will adapt to that specific niche. But outside of really specialized examples, neck morphology, say 75% of the time, is relatively uniform to a degree.
All right. And then, right, I'm just thinking about the kinetics of a bird neck. And my arm and my hand are now an ostrich neck. And I'm imagining the audience is all doing the same. Right. My ostrich is now pecking, but that is just coming through my elbow. It's just one joint. Yeah. And that's doing a pecking motion.
Yeah.
So if a bird was to peck, is it always, you know, like that joint between the last cervical vertebrae, the one that joins the neck to the body? Is it always the motion of that and then the rest are held static? Or and are there any functions where, you know, like the whole neck articulates like slinky?
So going back to what I was previously saying, at any point along the vertebral column that includes the neck, you can't bend it at one particular junction. So between two vertebrae, you can't bend the vertebral column all at one particular place, otherwise you're going to bend the spinal cord and that's your animal unfortunately dead. So what birds do, they'll rotate, they'll rotate their each individual joint between each individual vertebrae kind of equally along the length of the column during most different movements. So that means they've kind of got a very fluid motion for pecking that involves a lot of different joints within the neck, not just one or two. So, but you'll still see quite a lot of the range of motion between a joint that will be highest at the base of the neck where it joins the rest of the body, just because if you move a little bit of those one or two joints towards the body end of the animal, then that's what you're going to see the biggest increases in head movement, for example. So the smallest effort for the biggest outcome.
Okay. What about birds? I'm trying to think of ones like a heron in flight where it can kind of like bend its neck in half.
Yeah.
What's the deal with that? How does that work?
So it's all about, you know, you need to, if you've got a big head like a heron and you're flying, it's going to take a lot of energy for you to hold your neck out straight when you're flying. So it's kind of more energy efficient for them to tuck in their neck and hold it closer to the body. So then they're not expending a huge amount of energy to support the weight of the head during flight. And a lot of birds do that. You watch a pelican fly, they'll tuck their necks in. You watch, you kind of can't see it because the skin kind of covers a lot of the underlying skeletal morphology in penguins. But if you look at penguin kinematics, when they are swimming under the water, they'll tuck their head quite close to the body as well. So they're not, well, until they need to, when they're kind of picking fish out of the water, they'll kind of dart their head forwards a little bit. But most of the time, they're retracting it as well. So that retraction is seen in a lot of birds, just so they don't use too much energy of their neck supporting their head during flight.
Okay, so how does that bend? Is it like a nice smooth S shape in each of them?
Yeah, so the S shape is an important kind of shape in neck morphology because that's kind of the default setting, if you will, of bird necks at rest. They will come to some level of S shape. And that S shape is achieved by rotating each individual joint of the neck to a similar fashion. Like some joints within the neck may have slightly more or less than the previous joint, for example, but that rotation will be spread across the entire neck. So like I said, the neck doesn't bend the spinal cord too much.
Okay, so then wrapping up the birds, what are some of the most notable bird necks?
So we've discussed the anhinga or the darter bird with kind of a very hinge-like joint, which allows it to spearfish. That's one of my personal favorites. The neck of penguins, their musculature is entirely different to anything I've seen in bird neck morphology. Hopefully we'll publish on that someday. Ostriches, they're just too damn long, in my opinion. yeah. Parrot necks. I've been studying parrots a lot recently. They do a lot of cool things. Parrots can ascend trees. They can climb trees almost vertically by using their head, neck, and hind limb in tandem with each other. So they can climb trees as we would, but instead of using their hands, they use their neck and their head. It's kind of how we'd use our hands, and their neck morphology is really weird, but that's something we're currently studying. So yeah, I think that's my top three, top four, third necks.
So not even a surrogate arm in parrots, but also a surrogate leg.
Yeah, it's tripedal locomotion, and vertebrate body plans are kind of restricted to an even number of limbs, but apparently in a functional capacity, parrots have three, which is what we refer to as a forbidden phenotype. It shouldn't happen, but here we go. Parrots can do that. That's really cool.
Do they have different gaits? That'd be really interesting.
Parrots can do a lot of
unpublished stuff now.
Yeah, it's well, there is a paper currently out from last year all about parrot tripedal locomotion due to the kinematics and how it actually works, which has been published. It's a really cool paper. I think it's Reader Young's. But we're looking into, well, what is the morphology behind that? And that's something my master's student is working on at the moment.
I thought I'd found a new avenue of unpublished work that we could exploit, but now someone's beat us to it. Right. Okay. So we're finally getting on to the evolutionary side of things now after quite a bit of current biology. Like all of that context that you had to put into, you know, like understanding bird necks before looking back at the fossil record just to have that context.
Yeah.
Like the amount of stuff that we've just had to cover now just to get the basics down, and it's not even all known. So what is the first bird in the fossil record? And did this already possess a neck that's similar to some of the modern birds?
If we keep it, if we keep our early bird phylogenetics and taxonomy as simple as possible, which I like to do, as more of a current evolutionary biologist, then we started to think about birds like Archaeopteryx. And even by that point, we can see it does have a relatively long neck compared to other theropod dinosaurs. The cervical vertebrae, their morphology is less robust, it's more gracile, so less thick and chunky and more slender. We're starting to see almost kind of an S-shaped curve, because a cool thing that we see in modern birds, which relates to the fossil record, is when birds and dinosaur theropod dinosaurs die, their neck muscles kind of dry up and contract. And that means you get kind of this pullback of their head and neck, so then the head and neck are kind of bent backwards. And that's called an epistotonic neck posture. And we see that in a lot of different theropods and birds. So we're starting to see in Archaeopteryx, due to that head posture, head and neck posture in the fossil, which you can see in one of the most famous examples of Archaeopteryx, that we're starting to see that S-shape already starting to occur. So not only we're seeing morphology of the neck occur, we're also seeing postural changes in the early birds as well.
Am I wrong to be looking at these flexible necks as just the bird characteristic? I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to start at the dinosaur-bird transition. It could go further up the tree. Like, we started by saying that necks, like the first ones that we're seeing properly, were when vertebrates came out of the water onto the land. So is it more the case that vertebrate necks in general are nice and flexible, but and you'd look at things like a sauropod, and you'd look at something like Tanystrophius, that aquatic reptile, and plesiosaurs. Is it more the case that the things that we don't think of having particularly long necks, a Triceratops, a Lystrosaurus, or something like that? Is it the case that they have more reduced, robust, less specialized necks, but then, you know, like necks of vertebrates in general are flexible?
Yeah, and I think I during my research, I don't say that the neck of birds is the pinnacle or the start. It is just an interesting question as part of the evolution of flight and the evolution of birds, that their vertebral column just hasn't been studied in the evolution of birds and the evolution of flight in any single way. So that's why I take such a heavy slant towards bird necks being so amazing, because I think they do have an important part of that evolutionary story. But as you said, necks are important in every single animal that has them. And when you talk about Triceratops, for example, maybe having a more robust and less specialized neck, just because it's not super long doesn't mean it's super specialized. Like, Triceratops has fused cervical vertebrae called syndesacrals, which allow that enormous head and enormous frill in those horns to be supported at all times. So we see specializations in the neck throughout vertebrates. As far back as we see necks, we'll see some specializations to digging, to whatever ecological activity and ecological niche they're occupying. Necks are an incredibly important part of vertebrate biology, but we always overlook them because the head of animals is always where 99% of paleontology is at any given time, because yes, the head is incredibly important, but you know, the rest of the body exists, right? And the vertebrae is a critical portion of that skeleton, because we're called vertebrates. For example, that comes from vertebrae. So, you know.
All right. So you've just alluded to a neck specialized for digging. We're talking about necks supporting heavy heads. So I was just thinking about dinosaurs and seeing what we could apply from modern birds and what we know about how they function, their ecology, their behaviors, and seeing specializations in the necks for those behaviors and applying it to dinosaurs. But can we do that across all vertebrates then? We know in the modern times that a mole has a very... No, not a mole. That doesn't dig with its head. But which kind of animals have very specialized necks for specialized functions in the modern times? And can we apply that knowledge about how that neck functions to extinct organisms?
I'm going to give a kind of a vague overview rather than any specifics here, because I think it applies. As this is what I've tried to do with kind of the early part of my career. I really wanted to study dinosaurs. I still do. You know, I still do from time to time. But if you're looking at any kind of functional morphology or inferring any function in the fossil record, you've got to do your time in extant organisms. You have to understand your study system at such a granular detail that you can spout anatomy in your sleep, for example. So any functional morphology that you want to investigate, any adaptations to particular ecological niches, I think, you know, we can take a very positive attitude to paleontology. You can do it. You just have to use the extant phylogenetic bracket in clever and new ways to bound your fossil of interest and look into what we have in modern diversity to properly investigate any aspect of morphology you want to look at. And I think we can do it. You just have to look at the amazing diversity of animals and what function underlies that today. And there you go. You can look at any part of the body using that extant phylogenetic bracket.
Okay, so here is a question that is unscripted and probably going to get cut out. But do you feel that in the published academic literature that people haven't done that kind of due time in the modern system and will say like, oh, we've got this sauropod neck, it has superficial similarities to a swan, therefore it was pecking away and applying it incorrectly without naming names? And
I'm not going to step on any toes because sauropods, yes, we can ground it by looking at birds, but sauropods are so weird and absolutely enormous that anything that you say about what their necks are doing, to a degree, is you're going to be taking a leap of faith, because there's nothing like it in modern organismal diversity. So yes, you know, a lot of the studies that I'm aware of about sauropod biomechanics, they do, you know, do their due diligence. They do look at modern birds and a lot of like giraffes and other long-necked animals to connect the dots and use it for their inferences. But and they do make some leaps, but they have to, purely because sauropods, like I said, some of the largest, wackiest creatures that have ever lived. So you do have to just go all out and just say what you need to say. But you know, we could always use a little bit more functional anatomy and some more extant phylogenetic bracket. It won't hurt. But I think what we have is the best that we can do until we get some more ideas about how structurally they work, you know, more detailed functional modeling might come across. Who knows? We're getting really cool methodologies on how to model musculoskeletal function every single year. So that could be the way that we investigate, for example, sauropod necks. But people have given it a really good go so far. So, you know, keep on trucking.
Yep, but it's important to do, as we're stressing, it's important to do the work in the modern
absolutely
organisms.
Absolutely.
And that from my experience as well. I don't mind putting my neck out, saying that in my field with the sea scorpions, there was a paper published not too long ago where they said that it used its tail spine as a cutting implement, effectively as a weapon. And I don't think that they did the due diligence in understanding how these sea scorpions would be able to move. It was someone that wasn't an invertebrate worker, and they saw this fossil sea scorpion with its tail spine, which is all serrated, and it was right up, the body bent in a U shape, and it had its tail spine right next to its head. So they said, like, they caught prey and then hacked at it with its tail spine. And this this publication got in absolutely every news outlet, like, wow, we finally figured out how they use the tail as a weapon in this species. And it was just there, like, no, it was just an exuvia. It was a molted specimen. It didn't have any animal in it. It was just like the clothes that it had taken off, essentially. And that's the only reason why its tail spine was bent up around its head. So you got to understand the animal before making such claims. And so I was kind of worrying that, you know, as you said, that you had to do all of this due diligence in the modern systems, that kind of thing could just be jumped upon, could just be easily like, oh, we don't know about how necks in Tanistrophius or sauropods work entirely, so jump in with the headlines like, oh, we think it works in this way or that way, and all the newspapers go, yay, we figured it out.
But also, I think we do need to understand modern diversity and modern form and function. But a lot of the sauropod work has been general engineering concepts and general concepts of physics. And I really like those kind of simplified studies where they go, look, this is the rules of our universe. Can we make sauropods abide by those rules? And obviously you can, and that's how you get a decent hypothesis. It's a good way of testing it in a very rigorous scientific way. So even if we don't have perfect analogs, you know, you've got the rules of the universe to kind of ground you in a more physicsy sense as well, which I think a lot of other different studies could start utilizing as well.
So going back to birds now, how important would you say that their necks have been in driving their evolutionary success?
I think very important, and this is the end goal, hopefully, of my current work as part of my postdoc. I've alluded to the neck being utilized as a surrogate arm, for example. So during the evolution of birds, we go from theropod dinosaurs. This is a very reductive view of bird evolution, but just humor me while I simplify it. We go from theropod dinosaurs with functional arms, with enormous heads and kind of necks, which are basically purely adapted for supporting that head whilst providing some function during the capture and feeding of vertebrate prey. And then we get this shift towards birds with lighter heads, forelimbs that aren't able to manipulate their environment, and ultimately forelimbs which will be used in flying. So I think the neck acts as this kind of linking force between the whole front end of the animal, allowing head and forelimb evolution to kind of be correlated in some way with each other, so that when the birds evolve flight, that they don't have to lose any abilities to manipulate their surroundings. So basically birds can have it all by evolving this long flexible neck. They can be incredibly successful by evolving powered flight, but by evolving a highly flexible neck and a very dexterous beak, they can still manipulate their surroundings. They can still directly alter the niches that they occupy, which is a really critical aspect of avian behavior and avian biology. So I think this is the neck is that really critical link in between head and forelimb evolution in the bird to the dinosaur to bird transition.
All right. So to wrap things up, I just want to get an overview of necks in general and the current state of play. So what don't we know about modern bird necks?
We really don't understand a lot of the actual anatomy, the musculoskeletal anatomy. We have a lot of studies which investigate muscle anatomy of the neck in kind of commercially available taxa, so like chickens, ducks, ostriches to a degree because they can be farmed. But outside of these three or four clades, we don't understand musculoskeletal anatomy of the neck of birds. So someone really needs to go in with a scalpel and dissect as many different bird necks as possible. I tried to do it during my PhD, but only managed to get 15 or so. And just really understand what is actually going on under the hood. What's going on in terms of does the morphological diversity of the neck skeleton, does that match the morphological diversity in muscle morphology as well?
All right. And so what don't we know about the evolution of necks?
Like I was previously talking about, that relationship between the head, neck, and forelimb, we don't understand what was the initial impetus that allowed neck morphology to shift from theropod dinosaurs to birds. Was it the evolution of a smaller head in birds, or was it the evolution of the wing? We don't understand what are the driving forces in neck evolution. So to do that, we have to combine the work that I've been doing on modern birds, and then we need to look at the fossil record as well.
Okay, and for your research, what are you going to be studying next? Is it a secret?
No, not really. Very fortunate to be going on a lot of museum trips to look at a lot of theropod dinosaur specimens in North America and Canada. So finally, after 9-10 years, I managed to get my hands on some fossils, which will be nice.
All neck stuff?
All neck stuff. All neck heads and forelimbs of theropods that I can get my hands on in North America. So if you know of anyone, do get in touch. But yeah, that's going to be really cool.
Ah, interesting. Can't wait to see what comes out of that. And then a couple of throwaway questions that I have. Have you ever eaten a neck?
I haven't. We tried to get some... during the early days of my PhD, we tried to get as many different animals in to dissect. So I was having to like go down to Liverpool butchers and get like little scraps of neck meat, which was fun. We had to order game birds from wild game companies. But yeah, I've never actually eaten neck before. No,
I find it strange when you start recognizing muscles and muscle groups in the food that you're eating, and I find it really off-putting.
I think it's fun. I mean, it's not very fun at family dinners when you're pointing it out to your gran, but I think it's cool.
Oh, dear. Right, and if we had the technology to transplant a bird neck onto humans, would you want one? And if so, what would you have? Which avian functions would you like to be able to do with your neck and head?
I think I would, because I generally have like terrible posture when I'm at working. I kind of crouch over my laptop. So if I can have a longer neck so I can keep the rest of my spine kind of straight and not be hunchback all the time, that'd be quite nice.
Yeah, same actually. And yeah, any other necky anecdotes? I mean, I guess you've got your ostrich car adventure. There must be tons of neck-related situations that you found yourself in.
I guess one little small anecdote. I think during my PhD, I was thinking about getting myself a business card, and I'm always on the lookout for funny puns. And I was like, oh, why don't I put like Ryan Marek Nexpert onto my business card? But I was like, no one's going to take me seriously in this profession. So I decided against it. But now it's on this podcast, so I guess it's here forever.
Well, I'm going to introduce you as an expert then, as in the introduction, and then make it off as if it's my own pun. So because no one's going to listen all the way to the end of this, so they're not going to hear you actually do it first. So that's all good. I was just thinking, though, could you... If you got a business card and put kind of like an S fold into it and like had the front as a bird's head, you could then unfold the S bend and have the details on the neck of the bird.
I mean, you could, but
you could.
The amount of business cards that I throw away because, I like business cards, but ultimately... they're in the bin when I get home from a conference because I always forget to email people.
Yeah,
but
I've got a bowl. I don't know why it ended up in a bowl, but all the business cards that I've ever collected have ended up in
there. That's nice.
And I've never used a single one of them. I've never looked at a single one of them. And 11 years ago, when we started PaleoCast, happy birthday to PaleoCast for last week. I got a load of business cards, and I still haven't used them all.
Ugh.
Just, yeah. But if, you know, if it was in the shape of a bird neck, I might be more inclined to give them out.
Yeah. You had that idea, so it's technically yours. You crack on.
It's getting very American Psycho, so
we probably
should end it here. So thanks so much for coming onto the show today. Yeah. Cheers.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall and Liz Martin-Silverstone, with contributions from Tom Fletcher, Vish Venkat, and Elsa Pancharoli. Music was composed by Patrick Kendall-Smith. PaleoCast was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on funding from you, the listeners. So, if you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programs, and follow us across social media platforms to get all the latest news. Finally, if you enjoy our podcast, then please explore all of our video content on YouTube and follow our other projects, the Virtual Natural History Museum and the PaleoCast Gaming Network.